Kelton Barr, who most of us have known for quite some time here. And he's going to continue on with our theme of how does the water get through these aquifers.
Thank you, Scott. Well, this is going to be I guess you could call it a complementary approach to the more programmatic approach that Tony has taken. And this is the result of me being a consultant and having the chance to relatively intensively study small areas around the metro area. And in the process, have revealed the various quirks of the platfill, in this case, that I'd like to recount a number of these kind of projects and show the similarities that can develop and the picture of what flow in the platfill is like. As you probably know, the platfill is predominantly carbonate unit that's between a mine, a thin shale, the Glenwood shale, and a thicker shale where it's present, the Decorah shale. It's in the Twin Cities divided into five members. At the top is the Carimona member, which is actually now starting, is being reclassified as part of the Decorah, the last iteration that John Mosler has on the nomenclature. It has a bentonite layer that's in it that we can see. These bentonite layers seem to be fairly important, probably along the lines of what Tony was talking about in being able to be plastic enough that fractures can not penetrate as effectively. There's also a bentonite layer in the Glenwood that it's only an inch or two thick, and when they were drilling all the tunnels in the Twin Cities, they found that where that bentonite layer was present, the roof of their tunnels, which was on the bottom of the Glenwood, was dry. Where it was absent, water was raining in. So just that little inch layer was very important and can build up an 80-foot head on top of it in the overlying units. So these bentonite layers are important. This is underlain by the Magnolia, which is a massive, fairly a dolostone that's largely free of shales and other clastics. And at the bottom of it is a diastem, what's been called a diastem, a break in the deposition, but not a change in the depositional environment. And it's right overlying another bentonite layer. All of these things, I think, come into play in that unit that Tony was talking about and being preferentially removed. Below that is the Hidden Falls, which is a shaley dolomitic limestone that is generally the most aquitard like units within the platfill. Below that is the Mifflin member, one of the thicker members. It's the crinkly bedded, thinly bedded limestone that a lot of foundations in the older houses in Minneapolis and St. Paul have in their basement walls. And a lot of the WPA projects used for building bridges and walls and stuff. And finally, the Pecatonica is a sandy dolostone near the bottom. It's mainly the basal Magnolia and the Mifflin that most of the transmissivity can be found. And so I'll show you that as we go through several different projects around the Twin Cities. Now, unfortunately, there's not a lot of color differentiation between the Prairie du Chien and the Platteville here, but the grayer blue is where we find the Platteville subcropping in the Twin Cities. In Minneapolis and in St. Paul, the Platteville is subcropping under most of those areas. It's also found in the western suburbs, the eastern suburbs, and in some of the southern suburbs as well. Now, the first place I want to touch on is in northeast Minneapolis. At this location, there was a number of borings and monitoring wells being placed. Very quickly, it was noticed that we were seeing this bentonite layer in the Carimona, as well as a persistent gap, bit drop, of about an inch to half an inch in most of the borings at the bottom of the Magnolia member. And we ended up putting screens, well screens, that were specific to that gap at the basal Magnolia, and as well as putting screens in other parts of the platfill. And going back and doing some conventional comparison of heads in particular units, this is a map of the head contours in the glacial drift, mostly sand. And you can see that flow is indicated here from northeast to southwest, southwest being the direction toward the Mississippi, kind of the direction you expect groundwater to be flowing. Looking at the Carimona piezometers, very different pattern. Here we see a trough north, trending northeast-southwest with flow in from the northwest and the southeast to it. Very different. And then looking at the Magnolia, a persistent, a consistent pattern, but flow off to the northwest, which probably was the result of a large shaft open down into the St. Peter that was just off to the northwest. But very different patterns, and so we were starting to see the effect of the differentiation within a unit that's overall about 30 feet thick, plus or minus a couple feet around the... So what is that basal Magnolia parting or basal plane fracture, bedding plane fracture? That is what is shown here. It can be very uniformly eroded out in outcrop, and we have the massive Magnolia above it and the more shaley hidden falls below it. If we look just a few miles west of that last site, we put in a number of monitoring wells in the basal Magnolia. They're distributed around, spaced by several hundred feet around this rather triangular area. And the heads we were finding in the in these monitoring wells, excuse me, were only 1 or 2 hundredths of a foot difference. Very flat gradients. I mean, most sandy aquifers, you would expect to see a hydraulic gradient of 10 to the minus 3 order of magnitude. This was more like 10 to the minus 4 or less. Very flat. In fact, the time it would take to move around the site and take all the water level measurements, you could have enough fluctuation in water levels that you would have a very flawed picture of what the apparent flow directions are. To try and get around that, we put in some data loggers in 4 of these wells in the 4 corners and 1 in the middle. You can see very very close clustering of their levels, but moving in concert so that there is the overall effect of whatever perturbations there are in the potentiometric surface, but causing them all to move in concert. Now, you see a lot of scatter of these blue dots. This is for the monitoring well that was closest to the railroad. And these are actually the results of trains passing and the weight loading of these trains on the aquifer. Very sensitive. Okay, moving to the other side of the metro area, there was a number of series of monitoring wells that were installed in this area. Each time the potentiometric surface indicated changed dramatically. with each round. This is the final pattern that we saw. Again, you see convolutions, troughs, non-straightforward patterns. And this is a characteristic of, I think, of flows that are terrains that are dominated by fracture flow in joints and there's also some information that we were able to gather on the transmissivity of each of these different wells, and they range over several orders of magnitude, from less than 100 down here to 69,000, the next nearest well. Similar patterns up on the north end as well. This is also something that's sort of characteristic of a plat-fill setting. If we look along this line, along Century Avenue, at these three wells and what units they're actually completed in, we can see that the most transmissive well is actually screened in, open to the basal Magnolia and the Mifflin, and probably has exposure to a sand that's overlying the plat-fill. The middle well, with a transmissivity of less than 100 gallons per day per foot, is only screened in the Mifflin, and that's a fairly typical kind of transmissivity that you would see coming of flow through all these crinkly beds. The leftmost 7,700 is also screened in the Mifflin and the basal Magnolia. It probably is not as high because it's overlain by till, and it's also close to where the basal Magnolia is removed by erosion. Moving back to Minneapolis, to the Minnehaha Falls area, there was several episodes of investigation of the plat-fill and glacial drift in that area. This was a map made in the early 70s. Several dozen piezometers were placed in both the drift and the piezometers, the plat-fill in this area. And again, you see a very convoluted potentiometric surface that is indicative of, do you really have a picture of where the flow is going? Probably not. A series of pumping tests were conducted at that time, and these are the ranges of the actual values for the transmissivity that were collected at the time. And they range over four orders of magnitude. Several of them were down close to 1,000, but there was one that was 1.5 million gallons per day per foot. Now that's probably more than the collective transmissivity of all our major aquifers. That's quite a feat for a little 30-foot thick limestone layer. But there's also several others. Here's 500,000. Here's 700,000. Quite a range. And if you plot them in a logarithmic sense, you can see that there is quite a range of transmissivities apparent in just a small area. Well, fast forward a couple of decades, there was a pumping test that was carried out in this area. It was not what you would call a classical pumping test. The pumping was done from a line of about 100 dewatering wells along here, and the flow rate was rather ragged. This is the pattern initially in the glacial drift for the drawdown. But then there was a rainfall event. Rain collected in an excavation at the site, and it turned into a cone of depression and a cone of oppression. Not your typical classical pumping test. But the pattern in the plat-fill was very different. This is what we were getting initially. After a day or so, the pattern just accentuated with extensions off in a couple different directions. So we postulated that these were the result of some vertical fractures that were in the area. And notice here's north, pointing off to the upper left of the page. So it looked as though this pumping test was affected by some major major joints in the area. Could we find any information to corroborate these joint orientations? Well, fortunately, we were able to get a hold of some unpublished data that Bruce Olson had collected through a series of weekends crawling along the Mississippi River Bluff. He was measuring all the joints in the Platteville. Either it's an indication of how dedicated he is as a geologist or how little life he had at that time. But nevertheless, it's great data. And these are the joint patterns in the Minnehaha Falls area. And you can see there's a northeast and a northwest orientation. Here is a superposition of the joint orientation from the pumping test with that set of joint patterns that Bruce had measured. Very close correlation, especially since we're measuring this with a clumsy tool like a pumping test. How does that compare with some other joint sets? I mean, there aren't a lot of surfaces in the Twin Cities area that you can get an idea of what the joint patterns are. So in this case, we're looking at a series of joints from the bottom up, where the Platteville is being used as a ceiling for the U of M library, and Tony's already shown this slide. We know that these fractures are connected because not only are they conveying water to this library, they're also conveying some contamination from a site several blocks away. So they have a larger field of connectivity in this area. And there's also some joint patterns that we can see in the just above the St. Anthony Falls, where the dam is going around a section in the middle of the river. You can see these joints are plotted in this area here. And this is the pattern of distribution from that area. There are some that are off to the northwest, major direction, and there's others that are off to the northeast. Here's a comparison of these major directions superimposed on maps that are showing their locations as well. They're similar. They're not identical. I'll show you a little bit more about that later. But there is a pattern, and these joints are part of the flow pattern within the Platteville. And it's one thing to have an idea about what the lateral continuities are of the Mifflin or the Basal Magnolia. These are going to be also playing a role, and it's very difficult to get a handle on where these joints are. Going back to Minnehaha Falls, following the extension of the major joint pattern off to the southeast, there was a site right here, and you can see the clearing in the vegetation, where a grit chamber was constructed. And so it was constructed very close to this joint trend. And when that was excavated, water poured out of the Basal Magnolia parting. They had two 500-gallon-a-minute pumps to try and keep up with the flow. The other side of the excavation had water coming in, but at a much lower rate. So it looked as though the joint was conveying water near this excavation, and then it was conveyed to the excavation by the Basal Magnolia parting. It's noteworthy to point out, I think, that these high values, the 1.5 million to 500,000 transmissivities, these were all from wells that were very close to the location of this major north southeast trending joint. Now, there was some ground penetrating radar that was done in this area too, to try and do an aerial mapping of these of the joints, because the the overburden is fairly thin, and we can be seeing these fractures appearing in the rock, and we can also see tilted beds of just slabs of plat fill lying on the surface. And plotting them up, we can be connecting across lines, getting actual continuity of joints, and then connecting them up with our interpretation. And we can be comparing that to where there are springs along the bluff. There were a number of springs that were mapped out by Kathy Undum at this time. And we could see the correlation between where there were springs with where there were joints connecting the major fracture to the major joint to the bluff. Where the major joint passes close to the bluff wall, there is a series of springs. This is the Seven Springs area down in the side of the bluff area. And a couple of the black ash seeps that were mapped and are fairly unique ecological settings are directly related to where there are is discharge from collections of joints. Now we can also continue this joint pattern down to the southeast a few more miles, and we arrive at Camp Coldwater Spring, which is the largest spring in Minneapolis. Was the water supply for Fort Snelling for the 19th century. And it's located at the confluence of the basal magnolia parting, this major southeast trending joint, and another complementary joint that's coming in from the southwest. And it's at the corner of the outcrop of the Platteville. So it's fairly noteworthy that, you know, the largest spring is at the corner of the extent of the unit that it's coming out of. Not the usual place that you'd expect a spring. But it's explainable by the location of these joints. Now, during the course of the construction of the new exchange in this area, a couple of die trace tests were conducted. And I'll talk about B and C, these locations. At B, a trench was dug in the overburden, and a die was added with some water into that trench. And within hours, the die was arriving at the spring with an apparent flow velocity of about 465 feet to the spring in about an hour. So that's about 2.1 miles per day. That is a typical kind of number for a conduit flow. There was also dye added to a sump that was in the middle of the intersection, and there was an ISCO sampler at the spring collecting samples periodically. It took a couple weeks for the dye to arrive there, probably partly because there was some flow through the sand before it reached the wall of the Bedrock Valley there. But the dye did arrive and had a apparent flow velocity of about 60 feet per day. Again, that's higher than you would expect with just flow through porous media. So conduit flow, one, you can do a dye trace test. You can find pretty rapid flow rates. And that can have a lot of implications to whatever kind of study you're actually carrying out, and water quality and the like. Moving a little further north along eastern Minneapolis, a different kind of feature. This is a sinkhole. It's called the Seven Oaks Park. This sinkhole, right there. Whoops. You drop down about 25 feet to the bottom of it from the surrounding street that rings it. It's been there since Minneapolis was platted, and the farmer that homesteaded this area never farmed it and bequeathed it to the city on the stipulation that it be made into a park, and so it's been basically a park ever since. Now you know there's a big old sinkhole in eastern Minneapolis, right in the middle of the Twin Cities. In the 30s, they were digging a storm sewer tunnel in the upper part of the St. Peter, basically under the West River Road, which was a block away from this park, and they encountered this cavern. Mapping it at the time, they found it to be something like 500 or 600 feet long, L-shaped, a couple of jogs in it, and the passages were 30 to 50 feet wide and 20 to 25 feet high, with a lot of limestone block and fallen down to make the floor of the cavern. They thought, hey, great, this is a place we can dump a lot of sand that we're mining. So they filled up half of this thing with mined sandstone, sand, and that still remains in the cavern. Okay, this is what it looks like. This is standing on top of that pile of sand that's been placed in there. Ceiling of the platfill, one of the side channels that goes off, looking out into the main corridor. It's a fairly large cavern, and its location relative to the sinkhole is shown here. And you can see that it's just off to one side. Now, no one has really looked around the entire park to see if there could be other caverns ringing this. This looks to be where a breccia pipe has risen up through the platfill, through the St. Peter from the Prairie du Chien, and created the sinkhole that worked its way through the platfill. So this would be a collapse structure, different kind of karstic feature, but ending up involving the platfill as well. If you look at the aerial photo, you can see, and here's the park again, you can see that it's directly across the river from Shadow Falls, one of the main tributary valleys to the Mississippi between Minneapolis and St. Paul. And there's also a similar pairing of side valleys a little bit south of there. If these are indications of some joint patterns, they also seem to coincide with some of the patterns of the actual cavern itself. And so I'm showing you this, and the orientations of that joint pattern is similar to what we're seeing in these other joint patterns that we've been looking at, and comparing them all together, there is some close correlation between them all. So there's some regional pattern to all of this. So there is some predictability in how to look for these things in the metro area. One last kind of outlier is over in Woodbury. This is where an infiltration pond was being constructed for a subdivision. It was going to be constructed right on the platfill surface, and as they were scraping down to the actual footage, foot elevation that they needed the pond to be at, they encountered kind of a hole looking like that. And when it was excavated further, it turned out to be fairly large and actually continued on for about 120 feet until it finally disappeared into the wall of the excavation. They weren't going to go any further. So we don't really know how far it goes. There doesn't seem to be any deposition on the walls or ceiling. There is a lot of debris on the bottom of it, so it's hard to see what the bottom is like. But this is a feature that extends across this, and we really have no idea why it's there. Now, how many of those are there in the Platteville? There's just always going to be surprises, I guess, is the thing to be aware of and wary of. So let me summarize some general observations. The flow is biconduit flow, and kind of my corollary to exceptions prove the rules. Exceptions rule. And so you have to pay attention to the exceptions. They're telling you a lot more than the things that fit the normal pattern. The horizontal conduit flow is dominated by the basal magnolia, the parting, the bedding plane fracture, whatever you want to call it, that can be found fairly consistently throughout the Twin Cities area, and which has transmissivities on the order of 10 to the 4th to 10 to the 6th feet per day. And secondary, but much more minor, transmissivity is from the Mifflin, which has more of a transmissivity in the order of 10 to the 2nd to 10 to the 3rd feet square feet per day. Vertically, the solution enlarged joints, where they're found, are going to be major features. The question is how you find them. And where you're seeing apparent troughs in the potentiometric surface, that might be an indication of where one lies. It's certainly a place to start looking for them or suspect them. And if they excuse me, if the head distribution looks rather convoluted, be very cautious, because you cannot use this to predict what the actual flow directions are, much less transport pathways. Flow rates of miles per day are certainly possible, and we're still learning about what's going on in that fairly thin and fairly shallow bedrock unit. Tony is doing great work with his team, and I'm looking forward to hearing more of what they find. Thank you. Looking at the bluffs from Minnehaha Falls down to Fort Snelling, we looked at those fairly closely and did see a lot of continuation of joints through the St. Peter. In fact, some of them would have looked like lava flows of sand coming out of them. So there is water moving down through them, coming out, probably infiltration, transient flow, but water can move through the actual joints themselves in the St. Peter, and they're coherent joints that you can see in a unit that's not that. Whereas the Decora, I really haven't had a chance to really see if they continue up. And I guess the way to answer that was where that joint was close to the bluff edge. That's where we saw springs. Where it was not, there were no springs along there. We would have several miles. I think Kathy could confirm this. We had several miles in which the rock was certainly jointed, but there were no springs issuing out of those. So it looked as though what cross flow there was in the basal magnolia was intercepted by the joint. It also had a discharge point, the spring. So that also made it easy for an effective interception. If the spring was not there, there may have been flow across it. So the effect is that the joint dominated, overruled the lateral flow in the basal magnolia.
What came first, the joint or the bedding plane?
Yes. Yeah, no, I think you raised a good question about all that. How far back do they all go? And very likely, they're all very old. I think people that have had the means to study the location of joints and locations of valleys find that river valleys get eroded preferentially in areas along the pathways of joints. So that doesn't mean that they are always going to do that. And so there could be some joint control of the actual location of the modern Mississippi. And you can see certain stretches that it is very straight, and then it turns a fairly abrupt angle, and then it goes straight again. Are they following particular coherent joints as it was eroded in the first place? That I don't know, because we have not been able to tunnel under the river to look at that. So, but it certainly raises suspicions, especially if you can see that there are other valleys that seem to have the same pattern as that particular reach of the river. So. It's probably one of those straws that we geologists grasp on to try and make sense of it all. So,
you might mention the very successful horizontal well that was installed just upgrading from the Painting Library and dropped the floor of those ceiling joints by about 90%.
That's right. Thank you. that was quite an engineering feat to put that in, I'm sure. And cost several million, but you're right. There was an effective interception for the library flow, and has been able to.
And it was charged right along with it. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Kelton.
Thank you.